This podcast is in no way affiliated with the Stars production or Diana Gabaldon. All views expressed are solely our own. Welcome to the Outlander podcast,
where the men are kilted, the women are winsome,
and the whiskey is neat. Welcome to episode 238 of the Outlander podcast. I'm Ginger.
And I'm Summer, and we are in love with all things Outlander. So I know it's been a while since I've said announcements. But there was an announcement today because Miss Katrina Balfe won an award for her portrayal as Claire Beecham Randall Fraser. I feel like the biggest news should be her adorable haircut.
It is quite adorable. It's very 20s, isn't it?
It is. It's very, very like flapper.
She looks good at almost any time period, as we've seen, but she rocks the 40s. She rocks, of course, the 18th century 40s and the 1940s. But if I'm not mistaken, in interviews, she said that her favorite time period as far as fashion personally was the 20s. So that's kind of cool.
Okay, it's the IFTA Film and Drama Awards. She won Best Actress Drama for Outlander. Very cool. Congratulations, Ms. Katrina.
This episode is part of our Drums of Autumn read-along. To find out more and how to participate, visit outlanderpod.com/DOA.
And now, on to our read-along. This week, we are beginning part 5, which is kind of a bait and switch title because, now granted, no, it was the 60s. With a part name like Strawberry Fields Forever, it's a very loaded title name because I thought at first we were going to be going back to the 60s. But it comes out, we find out, not in these two chapters we're discussing tonight, but there's way more meaning involved in that. But we'll call it a double entendre. So we'll be beginning a chapter, part 5 with chapter 14 entitled Flee from Wrath to Come.
Erica B. writes, I did a little research on this title. Most, if not all, of us know that this is the name of a Beatles song. Of course, she means the part, Strawberry Fields Forever. This particular one I am not too familiar with, so I went to the internet. It has a dreamy feel to it, and according to Wikipedia, Strawberry Field was formerly owned by a rich merchant, but the property had a children's home for a very long time after that and was a favorite spot to play for a young John Lennon. Quote, Lennon grew up near the home. One of his childhood treats was the garden party that took place each summer on the grounds of Strawberry Fields. Lennon would often scale the walls of Strawberry Fields to play with the kids in the Salvation Army home. The proprietors complained to his school about his antics, but to no avail. Finally, they took him to his aunt, Mimi, with whom John was living. She told him if he continued to do this, they would hang him. He continued anyway. Thus the line in the song, nothing to get hung about, Strawberry Fields Forever.
That's a little strong. Just like, you know, when I nonchalantly tell my daughter that if she doesn't stop doing something, I'm going to beat her. I have never touched her in an aggressive manner whatsoever. So when I say it, she looks at me and goes, okay, mom, and rolls her eyes. But it feels like that statement was hyperbole on the part of the aunt to try to, or aunt to try to get him to stop doing the bad behavior.
With this information about Strawberry Fields, it gives us some information about what we might feel with this section. Simply put, a place that is loved and dear to those that will live there. A smidge all ahead of us, but not too far. Now the chapter. Pollyanne, remember, that's the runaway slave who attempted to help the white Alyssa Garver slip a bairn. Mm. Pollyanne was hidden in a tobacco shed. So they found her and they hid her in a tobacco shed until they could get to her to help run her out of town, literally, so she would be saved. Jimmy and Claire et al. Arrived at the meeting point at dusk. And it's Jamie, Claire, Pollyanne, Young Ian, Rollo, and John Quincy Myers, right?
Yes.
They picked her up and got her on a horse and they're off. But it was obvious, they see, that she'd never been on a horse before. So there's that. It was a little bit entertaining, but also she was scared out of her wits. In general, she was scared in general because of the whole situation. She knew it was like a very dangerous situation and she's willingly going with them. But yeah, I mean, this big animal, you've never been on it. I could see her being afraid.
Well, not only that, but let's also consider the fact that she's a small, like she's not tall. So she's diminutive and she's surrounded by very tall white men who have shown up and there is a language barrier. So, you know, I think she understands more than she can speak, but still, I would be very disconcerted to have giant tall men show up and take me off and then put me on a horse. And I mean, the whole situation must be totally fish out of water for her.
Now, before we go on, are you scared of horses, Summer?
No.
Do you want to tell us a story about a horse?
Do you want me to tell you a story about a horse?
In an earlier episode, you've mentioned the story where you and Lene were off galloping and you had a runaway horse. We don't need to say the whole thing again, but you're not afraid of horses in general.
No. No, okay. And I think my will to not be bucked off of a horse is greater than any horse that's tried to buck me off to this date. I'm sure there is a horse alive who would be able to supersede that, but this horse tried to buck me off and I did not lose my seat.
Allow it?
I didn't allow it for several reasons. One, I knew that if I fell off that horse, I would not be able to get back on because I needed a stepladder to get on it in the first place because it was very tall and we were on a beach. So I was like, I don't want to walk back. So far, knock on wood, my desire to stay on a horse has exceeded the horse's desire to get me off his back.
So you would not think of, and for whether it's someone you date or a future husband, whatever, in some kind of romantical situation, you would not find horseback riding on a beach romantic.
I mean, it could be.
I mean, the ambiance is definitely romantic, but if you're worried about dying, it's probably not a good romantic situation.
I mean, I don't worry about death. I've never ridden a horse and worried about death, even though that is a very real possibility. People die all the time from, like, Christopher Reeves. I mean, he didn't die, but he was paralyzed for the rest of his life from a fall off a horse. It's not a safe thing. I don't have that fear in me, but I know a lot of people who've thought twice about it.
The woman, Pollyanne, was so scared she was moaning. They were afraid that she'd attract attention. Claire said that she could ride with her. And so she did, behind her. And she was holding on tight to her waist the entire time. Imagine this poor slave woman, or soon-to-be ex-slave woman, stolen and likely sold by her own people from her own homeland to white men. Or, I mean, there may or may not. I don't know the history, and I cannot state for sure that there were no actively, I mean, obviously they would have been lower on the totem pole, but I don't know if there were any active non-slave, I mean, I guess they could have been slaves, but non-slave black people on those slave ships. You know what I'm saying? Like there could have been servants or slaves who were not being transported. You know what I mean? But that were working on the ship for the people. But yeah, so imagine her sold by her own people or captured in some way. Many times they were sold by their own tribes or by some people in their own territories to the slave ships. And then from there, the slave ships, you know, got to the Indies or whatever their final destination was, sold at a market, right? At an auction, sold again, just all of this. And then she helps out a white woman attempts to help her out of a very sticky situation. And now she's scared out of her mind. All of this, one of those things is enough to like end your life or to make you scared shitless. But all of this happens in just about a year. And she knows about the law of bloodshed. So she's like, yeah, let's go. Take me to those Indians. Take me now. Let's go. Because she's like, Yeah. So this woman has been through a lot. And then you add Rollo to the mix. I mean, poor woman can't get a break.
I mean, she just got one. She doesn't hasn't realized it yet, though.
Well, she has a break with them taking her to escape. That's a huge break.
Well, yeah, but considering the future she is potentially having now, as opposed to the one she's just been taken from, I think she has received quite a break.
Escaping certain death, that's a huge plus. But yeah, so escaping that and being taken into a place where in a better life that, you know, maybe not as good as in her homeland or as much as she would have loved to have had that. But second to that, it's much better than being a slave. Absolutely. So Erica B. writes, we start off the chapter with a gang helping the woman who accidentally killed the woman who is pregnant. She must be so scared, I can't imagine. She doesn't know the language of the people transporting her and only knows roughly that freedom is the end goal. And that's a smidge early. I get to that. I do include that in a quote coming up. Jamie checks in with Claire. He says, even he doesn't know where they're actually headed. Jamie uses one word. He's sure Pollyann will know. Seorasa. And of course, that could be butchered. It probably is. And it means freedom. They ride on through the night, only stopping briefly. Diana gives us metaphors of a ship voyage. Quote, the fatigue of long riding crept over me, too, aided by the hypnotic soft thudding of the horse's feet and the unending susurrus of the pines overhead. We were still in the longleaf forest, and the tall, straight trunks surrounded us like the masts of long-sunk ships. Unquote. The hypnotic sound of the horse's feet, the vehicle they were using, like the hypnotic feel of a ship at sea, when it's not rough sea, of course. The sound of the pines overhead, like the sound of the sea, the waves lapping up against the ship, and then the tree trunks like masts around them. And then more, the heave and fall beneath me, the rise of planking, and the sound of the pines, the wind in our sails, unquote. Erica B. writes, I want to know how Claire knows all these types of trees. It is possible she learned about them while in Boston or studying plants for medicinal purposes. As someone who grew up an hour outside of Boston, persimmons are not common around here, nor are chinkapin. While I have heard of other common trees to my region, like ash or elm, I couldn't point one out to you. I can easily identify a number of trees all local to me. Regardless, I'm sure I couldn't identify as many trees in an unfamiliar area as Claire does. So they stop again at dawn and finally sleep. They were on their way again at sunset. But before they leave, Claire is doing her routine tick check of her hubs, while Myers is looking over young Ian. Now, Pollyann had tried to be, or is, as helpful as she can be. She got water for them, and she taught Claire a thing or two about removing ticks. First, you get water in your mouth, you spit it at the tick, and then you tickle the tick and the victim.
It was more than water. She had seeds in her mouth, and she chewed them with the water and then spit the water with the chewed up seeds in it.
I'm happy that I didn't do that. So Erica B. writes, gross. Nothing like waking up covered in ticks. No thank you. But hey, at least they didn't have to worry about Lyme disease. Even worse, Jamie is all meh about them. Sorry, that was not supposed to sound like a goat. That was he doesn't care about them. But I suppose with the absence of Lyme disease, does anyone know if there are any issues with tick bites generally? That's a good question. Other than being annoying and disgusting, I don't know. Any entomologists or medical people know anything? What are the dangers of ticks besides bloodborne pathogens or disease like Lyme disease?
I think that they can get infections if they don't remove the whole tick. Because if they pull them off and the head is in there, they can get infected. And infection is a huge problem in a time without penicillin.
So Pollyann, as Summer said, she's quite short. Claire sees she's no more than about 4 feet. That is teensy. Quote, She looked like nothing so much as one of the carved African fertility images, unquote, that she had seen in the Indies. And her voice, Polly Ann's, is crazy deep. She also pointed out something that looked like lima beans, did Polly Ann. She called them pawpaw and said that you can't eat them. You can't eat the seeds. They're poison. And as we learned how she got rid of the tick, she's a dangerous spitter. I think that's her superpower. She's a good spitter. Summer, if you can't swallow the seeds because they're poison, but you can chew them up and eat them, I'm very confused.
That's what she was chewing and spitting at the tick.
But she only did that one time.
Yeah, she was showing her what to do to kill the ticks. She'd already chewed the seed up and spit it at the tick. And then she showed them again, you know, you can chew them and then you spit it. And I think that whatever it is coats that, because they ticks breathe through their butts. It sounds bad, but they breathe through their rear end, their hind quarters.
No, but I wasn't expecting that. Oh, that makes sense, huh? Because otherwise they'd suffocate.
Exactly. So they breathe through their skin. And so she's coating their skin with whatever that poisonous
pawpaw.
So with the water pawpaw mix, they spit that on the tick and it coats their butt that they're breathing through. And then they
butt. Oh, do they have more than one butt?
No, they have the one butt. It coats the...
They have the one butt. You said it coats the butt they're breathing through.
Well, yes, it does. It coats the hindquarters of the tick, their quote-unquote, their breathing apparatus. And then she tickles them and then they fall off. And I've read a bunch of stuff. There's other things that you can use for that same purpose. Some people use, there's like essential oils that you can use.
Oh, that makes sense.
Or olive oil, like oil-based things in general. And if you coat them, they can't breathe through it.
That makes sense.
That's all I have. But yes, they breathe through their butts.
That will not be an episode title. Thank you.
It should be.
Lorraine B. writes, in chapter 14, we learn that apart from spiriting Polly Ann away to safety, Jamie is relying on Myers to show him the way into the backcountry before the snow flies. Some writers might treat this an A to B trip, with the payoff in story coming at the destination. Instead, we're treated to vibrant descriptions of Polly Ann, quote, she was very short, no more than 4 feet, and nearly as wide, with a close-cropped head like a cannonball, her cheeks so round that her eyes were slanted above them, unquote, etc. This character has little to no dialogue, and yet we come away caring for and feeling that we know her. And she teaches us how to get rid of ticks. I could have used some pawpaw seeds to rid my cat of the 2 ticks he picked up this summer. Then they're up and at him again. Polly Ann attempts to ride alone. She opens up a little bit to Claire. Now, no, they're not having a full-on English conversation, but they are able to communicate a bit more with a mix of English, Gaelic, and her own language. And Claire remarks that she's so expressive that she was able to kind of, you know, get a lot of a gist, an even better gist of what she was talking about. So as they pass through a large clearing, Polly Ann became silent and afraid again. She said that it was a bad place. Myers believes it was a Tuscarora village once. No idea why it was abandoned. They continue on. Their surroundings change as they ride. New trees, flowers, smells, etc. By sunset, I mean, they're like suddenly, like, dang, woman, you like got there. By sunset on the sixth day, wow, they were, quote, that's a who, yeah, oh yeah. They were, quote, well into the mountains, unquote. Geez Louise, it was absolutely stunning. Young Ian is gobsmacked. I mean, they all are, but young Ian is so expressive. They camped for the night near a creek, and Jamie and young Ian go fish. Polly Ann is helping with the cooking, and Claire expresses more than once how she's getting a little bit tired of the corn dodgers. It's their last night together. They'd reached the backcountry, the limits of the King's Land. The next day, Myers would take Polly Ann north into the Indian lands. Claire thinks, what could Polly Ann possibly be thinking? What was the place like that she came from? And what future was she going into? Rollo is going around sniffing rudely, as Diana writes, at people. Now, is this Diana's term for crotch sniffing? I'm thinking, yeah. And when he got to Pollyanne, homegirl spit in his eye. He deserves it.
I'm gonna have to work on that as a tactic.
To my cats?
For unwanted
crotch sniffing?
Male attention.
Oh. Sorry, I thought you meant just the dogs. Quote, I laughed and decided not to worry too much. Anyone capable of spitting in a wolf's eye would likely cope with Indians, wilderness, and anything else that came along, unquote.
Did anyone else kind of want there to be a novella with the adventures of Myers and Paul, what is
Pollyanne.
Her name?
Pollyanne. And young Ian, because they were all together.
No, I just want, I ship them. I ship Myers and Pollyanne.
I think there's evidence for a shipping in later books, but I don't want to get ahead. Am I wrong?
There might be. And that may be, I mean, it's been a while since I've read later books because I'm so inundated in the earlier books now that we've been doing read-alongs. I'm trying to not get too far ahead with the storylines, but right now, in this moment, I want a bulge of like the adventures of Myers and Pollyanne as a couple.
She wants
John
Myers to have a bulge in his pants. She wants Pollyanne to have a bulge in her belly. And she wants a book. And she wants a book bulge.
He has had nothing but bulges in his pants.
That's true. He had a third bulge.
Right. Okay. I'm saying he's been plentiful in the bulge arena.
As Claire is pondering their being in absolute wilderness, she says, quote, our fire seemed the merest spark against the vastness of the night, unquote. By the time they're eating, quote, the fire seemed more substantial now, the scent of cooking food spreading its warmth in a wider circle, keeping the night at bay, unquote. So the wilderness has retreated a little. Jamie is in heaven. He has never, he says it like four times, he has never seen such fishing as he's seen there at their stop in the mountains. Young Ian mentions that his father, Ian Sr., would have given his other leg to have seen it.
Would he have, though?
No, he would. That's awful. Come on, Ian. Young Ian. Lorraine B. writes, I wonder when Myers says, in part of their trip, one of the things they see is some waterfalls. And young Ian remarks on how amazing they look. And this is what Lorraine is referring to. Lorraine B. writes, I wonder when Myers says, quote, ain't the biggest falls I've seen, but it's nice enough. And Ian asks, oh, there are bigger ones? And Myers replies, boy, you ain't seen nothing yet. I wonder if he's talking about Niagara Falls, whose drop is a little more than double the one they're looking at. Very possibly. Myers talks about how the Indians fished, like their methods, but using like a trap,
there's several ways, but it sounds like the biggest way is they create like a dam in the river and then they speared them from above.
Young Ian was gone for the Indians. He was enamored of them. He wanted to know everything about them. And this is not the first time. I think it was in the last chapter. If not, then no, I don't think it was the last chapter. At least two chapters ago, but I've said it at least once already in our read-along that in Simadana, because Diana gives us early and often about Ian and his Indian love.
Secret lovers, yeah. That's what we are. I was trying to work Indian into that, but it didn't work.
No. Myers gives a history lesson about the Tuscarora War, when some backcountry settlers had been attacked and the governor of the colony sent troops to deal with the attackers.
That was very like 21st century. You got to deal, guys. I'm sending you guys to deal.
I think I am in the 21st century, and a lot of my stuff is really verbally like that. The colonists had been better armed, so of course they had won easily. And it was a devastation for the Tuscarora nation. There weren't more than 7 villages of theirs left, and very few people left. They'd been formally adopted by the Mohawk and become part of the Iroquois nation. Jamie finally brings out the scotch, takes a little bit, and gives most of the bottle to Myers. Erica B. writes, Pollyann gets visibly upset when they come to the clearing. According to Myers, he thinks it was once a Tuscarora village that has been destroyed. The war he briefly mentions occurred in the early 18th century. I think he said something like 40 years before that time. And this is a quote from the Wikipedia entry of the Tuscarora War. Quote, the first successful and permanent settlement of North Carolina by Europeans began in earnest in 1653. The Tuscarora lived in peace with the European settlers who arrived in North Carolina for over 50 years at a time when nearly every other colony in America was actively involved in some sort of conflict with Native Americans. However, the settlers increasingly encroached upon Tuscarora land, raided villages to take slaves, and introduced epidemic diseases. After their defeat, most of the Tuscarora migrated to New York, where they joined their Iroquoian cousins. Unquote. Diana continues her description of various tribes or nations, focusing much, longtime readers will understand, on the Mohawk. Myers is the vehicle for this education. His role really is quite large in this book. You know, it's not just the guy with the extra testy. I mean, he's helping them. He's giving them all this. He is the vehicle for them getting to the backcountry. And Pollyann is the why, right? So the how is Myers and the why is Pollyann. So a lot of the story came to get them to where they're at. There's a reason coming up in a chapter very soon. Myers tells us that Mohawk are the fiercest of the six nations. No one, red or white, he says, quote, going to mess with the Mohawk, thought good cause, unquote. Part of this is explained by this passage. Myers, quote, they're fierce, all right, but they're mortal. Indians are men of blood, and none more than the Mohawk. They're men of honor, mind, but there's a sight of things they'll kill for, some reasonable, some not. They raid, do you see, amongst themselves, and they'll kill for revenge. Ain't nothing will stop a Mohawk bent on revenge, save you kill him. And even then, his brother or his son or his nephew will come after you, unquote. Wow, that sounds a little too uncomfortable. Quote, sometimes Indians don't kill for any reason a man would say mattered, especially when liquor's involved, unquote. Claire writes, yeah, Claire joined us, you guys. Claire says, sounds very much like the Scots. And Jamie basically like gives her a stink eye. He does not find that amusing. Myers says that Indians don't hold their liquor well. The reason that they adopt some people into their tribes is because it's a bloody life and they need bodies. They need people. It helps replace those who are killed or who die of sickness. They take prisoners sometimes into a family and treat them as their own. And that's what Myers believes they'll do with Pollyann. Again, young Ian is enamored. This is like a form of lust almost.
Well, let's be honest. Myers is doing a really good job of romanticizing the Mohawk tribe right now. And in a way that is everything, every young boy in the 1700s all the way up to now thinks about when they play cowboys and Indians. And I know that's not PC anymore, but you know that when you grow up, the kids all wanted to play cowboys and Indians. And this is though in this particular story, it's not cowboys and Indians, it's Scots and Indians or whatever else you want to do, but it's a very romanticized tale of the bravery of the strong Indians and you know the stoic and all of the strong characteristics of the Native Americans in this time. And he is totally just pitching everything in the way that Ian is ready to receive it.
Young Ian asks Myers if he can speak Mohawk. Yes, he can. Now, he doesn't say that he's fluent, but he's been around it enough and been with traders enough that he's like, if you're a trader, and he's not necessarily only a trader, but you can't help but pick up, you know, some of it. But yeah, he definitely is able to be conversant. And he asks if they'd have seen the Mohawk, a black woman, before. Myers laughs. He thinks they'll find her handsome. Quote, they do like a woman as is sweetly plump, unquote. Myers also thought so, and he let her see it.
I ship it.
And when she did, I loved, every time I read this, it's like, it like always surprises me every time. Polly Ann's demeanor changed. Her posture changed, quote, suddenly curved in a promise of lewd abundance, unquote. Wow. I mean, yeah. Claire gets Jamie to break up the tension. Myers assures Jamie that Polly Ann will be safe. The women get to choose whom they bet.
It's totally the 180 of Ulysses' reaction to, like, when he sees, you know, I mean, but Polly Ann had the same response that Claire did, but with the opposite, you know what I mean? So it's like, whereas when a male appraises, where Ulysses was, you know, saw Claire as a woman and, you know, appreciated her, you know, Claire had the same reaction of, oh, well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. And the difference is that, you know, the roles are reversed. So as where if when a white person, you know, a white man has that reaction to, you know, the slave in this situation, that, you know, she is not, you know, I am horrified by my reaction to this. You know what I mean? It was the juxtaposition of those two kind of not real, really, they're not like fleshed out relationships, but those two situations I thought was interesting.
Young Ian speaks up and says that Myers has invited him to go along. And by this, he means to go along with him and Polly Ann to take her to the Mohawk. And he specifically hadn't asked permission. He denounced it in front of everyone as a done deal. Young Ian did a cunning thing there. And Jamie, you know, Ian has a bit of Mackenzieism, doesn't he? Mackenzieism. Mm-hmm. Ian has a bit of Mackenzie in him, doesn't he? Because he's a little bit like Jocasta there. Like Jocasta was going to, granted, it's a much bigger deal, but Jocasta was going to announce in front of God and the world and everyone that Jamie was her heir and not give him a chance to and have it be done.
He has to turn
exactly,
him down.
Exactly, because if he had said no, yeah, that would have been, because he couldn't have. He said as much. And so here, obviously, it's not the same. There's no stakes. Nothing as high as those stakes, but dang. Erica B. writes, oh dear, this is when Ian's love affair with the Indians begins. Well, okay, no. It began a number of chapters ago, probably at the beginning of the book. But I continue for Erica B. It starts off with simple questions and then the idea of going to the village with Myers and Polly Ann. At the very least, I hope that Ian can serve as a tool to keep Myers' hands off of Polly Ann. Now Polly Ann is cupping herself and smiling at Myers. Dude. Claire understands, though. She was binding herself, at least for now, to a man on whom she relied to get her safely to her destination. And Claire realizes that there were some similarities between her and Polly Ann, but also that there were differences. Quote, however unknown my future, it would be shared, and the bond between my man and me went much deeper than the flesh. Beyond all this was the one great difference, though. I had chosen to be there, unquote. Lorraine B. writes, so what could have been a very boring ride into the mountains, we find out useful information about the Tuscarora, Ian's burgeoning independence, and the difference between Polly Ann and Claire's dependence on a man for survival. This is truly a story about a couple whose strengths and weaknesses complement each other, with neither dominating nor being portrayed as better or smarter than the other. Erica B. closes us out with, I am only a little bit disappointed that there isn't a recipe for corn dodgers in my Outlander cookbook, as we hear a lot about them in this and the following chapters. However, by the sounds of it, no one really wants to eat them anyway. I think they could, like, even Claire said, I don't think she ever said they were like ambrosia, but she did say her description of them, how they smelled, all that stuff, and how they tasted was that it was much better early on. If you had to eat them for like 7 days, they, even if you kept cooking, number one, you got tired of them, like anything. But number two, they lasted, you know, they were portable, but they were kind of like little rocks.
It was like pretty hardtack.
I was about to say, like a hardtack, yeah.
And that was chapter 14. We will move on to chapter 15, entitled Noble Savages.
Lorraine B. writes, "For someone who goes camping, the opening part of this chapter takes me back to peaceful evenings, cooking up dinner and kicking back with a glass of wine, watching the fireflies flicker and the largemouth bass lunging at the bitty bugs on the water. It's not hard to join Claire and Jamie in their bliss and reflection." So the next morning, Jamie and Claire leave Myers, Pollyanne, and young Ian. They plan to meet again in 10 days. Like, they have got this like down. Gracious. It's like 6 days out. I guess 7 days, 6.5 days. And then the seventh day they part. And then 10 days later, they think, dang, someone's making real good time. So Myers and young Ian and Pollyanne and Rollo went north and Jamie and Claire went southwest. She watched their environment as they journeyed, knowing that this might end up being their home. They stop in the late afternoon and she sees fireflies. And we learn that she'd seen them first in Boston. Do you know when the first time I believe I saw fireflies, Sam?
Tell me.
The first time I visited you in, I think it was for the wedding in Georgia.
The first time I saw fireflies, because they are not indigenous to California, where we live, was when I was in New York City. And I freaked out because the first time I saw fake fireflies was at Pirates of the Caribbean in Disneyland. And I thought I was hallucinating when I was in Central Park, because you don't see them in like the city, but I saw them in Central Park, and we were there and it was getting to dusk and I was like, what is that? Am I hallucinating? They're like, it's fireflies. And I was like, are you kidding me? It was amazing. There is never anything that was so magical to me as an adult, like I still, when I see them, I'm filled with the wonder of childhood considering I never saw them in childhood, but I'm still filled with a childlike wonder whenever I see fireflies.
Jamie says that evening is his favorite time of day. Quote, "When I lived in the cave after Culloden, I would come out near evening, sit on a stone, waiting for the dark." Unquote. Claire remembers Father Anselm at the Abbey. Quote, "He said there was always an hour in the day when time seems to stop, but that it was different for everyone. He thought it might be the hour when one was born." What time of day were you born, Sam?
7:38 p.m.
Do you see that? I could go with that kind of time, if indeed that's something that, if there is a time where you have that kind of experience that Claire just described or Father Anselm describes, I could go with evening or 7:30 something. That to me kind of makes sense. Do you have that experience? If not every day, is there a time of day, but a consistent time of day that when it happens, you notice it's around the same time?
9:14 a.m.
Oh, okay. So you answered a different question.
It's a clock thing. So, and I would say I look at the clock at the same time. So it is a time of day thing, but it's that I feel like I look at the clock at the same time, meaning it's the same time of day that I do the same thing. So it's a...
The numbers are significant because...
Because it's my birthday.
Yes. And I noticed that on my month and day too. But as far as Claire's question, is there a time of day where time seems to kind of stop for you? Not a time like 9:14 or 10:22. I mean, a time period like light-wise.
Time of day when time seems to stop. Yes, but I don't get to see it very often. I've only seen it a couple of times, and that would be pulling all-nighters.
Oh.
And but not in the way you used to pull all-nighters. My all-nighters where I'm up partying all night and we made it till dawn. And there's this time, and I don't even know what time it is, because no one wants to look at a clock and feel the evening ending. But it would be when we were having parties when I lived in North Carolina, and it was just the way the light was. And when everything, it's sometime between nighttime and dawn, and this when everything would turn blue. So the sun isn't fully up yet, but it's bright enough that you can see. But everything around you has a tinge of blue. And I'm sure there's a term for it, but I've never experienced it on the West Coast. So I don't know if it is an East Coast thing or a Smoky Mountains thing or what, or North Carolina thing specifically, but there was a time of the morning before the sun comes up all the way when everything is starting to crest that everything just is blue and it seemed like everything stops.
Now, I don't have necessarily a time of day where things happen like that consistently, like a feeling like Claire described or Jamie did or you did. I have times in my life, which I know is a different thing, but I have times in my life where I feel like the not out of body experience, but feel like this is maybe not extra meaningful, but it almost like it just feels surreal. That's what Claire and Jamie are describing, right? Things seem to slow down. You almost seem outside of yourself watching, and it just seems surreal. It's like you're observing from another direction or another angle. I don't know. I don't know how else to describe it. I think everyone's had those types of moments. And the first one that came to my mind, which is kind of random, is in 2009, I was staying with my former host family in Switzerland. And I was in there December of 2009. And I was just before Christmas. It was in early December. And we went to my host family's daughter's like school kind of music choir performance. And I think it was in a church, or it could have been in like, it may not have been a church, but it was some gathering place where all the kids went. There were risers and everything. And we sat in the audience, and it was in the afternoon, because otherwise it would have been like hecka dark, right? Because it was early December. So we get there, we go inside, watch the thing, and then come out. And as we're waiting for the kids to come out and all the parents are saying hi and kind of greeting each other, of course, everything's in German. So it's like, I'm in lust and love. And actually it's Schweizerdeutsch. So I can only, I understand it, but I gotta like concentrate like heck. And it is one of the most gorgeous views. It is on a lake. Now you're like, oh, that's a lake. That's pretty. Oh no. Oh no. Swiss winter on a lake with snow all around. I mean, it was the most magical thing summer outside of Scotland, which is a different kind of beauty and majesty. But this was one of the most, it's imprinted. I think I have it on Facebook. It's imprinted in my mind. This view, it was so gorgeous and it almost made me cry. Not just because it was so pretty, but because it was like, I knew I was there visiting. I wasn't staying. I wasn't living there. You know what I mean? It was, I don't know. I don't think I was romanticizing it because I felt the exact same way that I do right now at that moment. And it only lasted for a few minutes because, you know, we had to get her daughter and then go on and leave and go home. But oh my gosh. So if you don't have a time of day that you consistently or regularly find that you feel like Father Anselm described or Jamie or Claire have experienced, or a time of day like weather-wise or light-wise, like summer described, something that you found absolutely beautiful on very special occasions, you know, maybe there's a moment that has to do with weather or a place. I don't know. I'd love to hear from you guys if you have anything. So now that I just took like, I just went sideways and talked about Switzerland because that makes me homesick for my other home. So my first home of my heart is Scotland. And then after that, it's probably Switzerland. But okay, I digress. Jamie says his was supper time. So maybe there was something to it for him. Huh. Jamie's birthday was one to remember, he says. His mom had been cooking when her pains came on. So suddenly there was no time to do anything. She goes into labor, the dinner burns, and there was only some pie, some gooseberry pie that was there to be eaten. And so the family ate the pie and everyone got indigestion due to the underripe berries. Everyone, that is, but Ellen and Jamie. Quote, my father said it was months before he could look at me without feeling his bowels cramp. Michael M. writes, we learn of the circumstances of Jamie's birth in this chapter, specifically the not-so-well-prepared gooseberry pie that the family ate in place of the dinner that was burnt because of the arrival of Jamie during the dinner preparations. Please raise your hand if you laughed along with Claire when Jamie told her. I can't raise my hand. First of all, there's no camera, so you couldn't tell. I could totally lie, but I'm not going to lie. My head has headphones. My mouse almost attached to a mic. One hand's holding a phone. I'm sitting in front of a computer. My right hand holds a phone. Left hand is, this is going to sound really bad. My left hand is cupping my cat's booty because she's sitting in the pouch of the sweatshirt that my sister got me.
This sounded a lot like it was going to become an Alanis Morissette song.
God, one end in my pocket.
Exactly.
The other one is stroking my...
No, just give me a high five. The other one is giving a high five. Let's just do that one. That one's clean.
I can't. I have no free hands. Literally. So, onward. Claire doesn't know the hour of her birth. Aw, that's sad. Brianna, however, she says was born at 3:03 a.m. Talk about witching hour. Here's another departure from the novel. Season 3 reflects Claire forcibly being put under for Bree's birth. Here in this chapter of Drums of Autumn, we learn that she had refused all drugs. She thought she was going to die and she didn't want to die in her sleep. Now, before I go on, no, we're not rehashing and making tons of comparisons. And this does not carry on. It doesn't have butterfly effect, I don't believe. However, do you think there was there a reason other than drama for having her be forced to take the drugs?
I think it was era specific. And I think that it also fed into all of the different ways that she was being
handled.
Yeah, by his boss at work. Like everyone kind of, you're being put in your place, forcibly put in your place. And, you know, this is the time period you're in now. And this is, you have to adjust. And it just seemed like one more thing. And I think it also, they were trying to do the parallels and to create more of a parallel between Faith's stillbirth and Brianna's birth.
Ah, that's true. And she wakes up not knowing what's going on.
Okay. Which gave that super effective moment of, where's my baby?
My baby, where's my baby? Yeah. So she said that she thought she was going to die and didn't want to die in her sleep. Jamie, though, wouldn't mind dying in his sleep. But he does say he wants it to be in bed next to her at a very advanced age. So, Summer, it's conversations like these that make me wonder if this is how Jamie will die in book 10. We are just guessing here. No one has said, even Diana, no one said he will die in any book. But I'm curious if Diana will give him his wish. If he does indeed expire in any of the books, which will be probably the end of book 10, if it happens, I'm wondering if it'll happen in that manner.
I think, you know, I don't know about that, but I would like to say that I think that everyone kind of wants to die in their sleep, unaware of dying. But that being said, I would not like my significant other to die in their sleep next to me in bed at a very old age. I don't want to wake up to that.
That's true.
That's awful.
That is pretty, yeah, that's pretty dramatic. Traumatic and dramatic.
Right?
Claire asks him what he thinks it'll be like to die. She quotes, "Man is like the grass that withers and is thrown into the fire. He is like the sparks that fly upward, and his place will know him no more." Jamie doesn't know. He says, "There's what the church says, but," quote, "no, I canna say, but I think it will maybe be all right," unquote. Summer, even this kind of talk guts me.
But look what he's been through. I think after you've been tortured as much as he's been, everything probably sounds like it would be okay. I'm like, eh, it can't be that bad. At least he's not being ass raped in Wentworth Prison.
Oh, Lord. She went there.
Well, I'm just saying, you think of all of the really traumatic things that have happened and death sounds like a nice release.
Quote, "I think it will maybe be all right. I thought so too. There was no telling what lay on the other side of life. But I had sat many times through an hour where time stops, empty of thought, soothed of soul, looking into what? Into something that had neither name nor face, but which seemed good to me and full of peace. If death lay there, dot, dot, dot." Lorraine B. writes, Claire quotes some lines from the Bible and asks Jamie, "Is there nothing after, do you think?" Meaning, is there something after death? He answers that he can't say and then says, "But I think it'll maybe be all right." Claire repeats this in her head and reflects on the quiet and peaceful times where time seems to stop and wonders if death lay there, maybe it would be all right. As Jamie's messing with the fire and the fish, and Claire is pondering the subject of the other side, Claire feels a, quote, "small round cold spot centered like a target on the back of her neck," unquote. She asks Jamie if there is something behind her. So before we go on with this, is there a time when, I mean, behind you, I'm mostly interested in like Claire, if it's behind you, but has there been a time when you have felt threatened, whether it ended up being a true threat or not, where your like skin has crawled or you felt something like that? I can't remember a time where I had a feeling like on like the back of my neck or between my shoulder blades or anything like that. The times I can remember where it's not behind me, I guess that's the difference. I can say this. The times I have felt that crawling, weird, almost borderline nausea of like your stomach falls through the bottom of your pants, right? And you feel something in your gut and you're getting this gnawing feeling every 100% of the time. It was a situation that was either dangerous or could have been dangerous. You know what I mean? So every single time I felt that feeling, I don't know that I've always listened to it. I haven't progressed, like gone further into the situation, but I may not have like moved. I mean, I may have been so afraid or so shocked that I stopped, but I didn't willingly go forward into more danger, if you know what I mean. I've always respected it. And sometimes like listened and then like ran away or went the other direction or whatever. But for example, I felt that weird feeling in our stomach when the five of us girls, I think you were there in high school when we stupidly threw a closed construction site that had barred on one side and a wall on the other.
It wasn't a construction site. It was a temporary walkway.
But they were doing construction there. We weren't in an illegal area. We were on a street. But the side of the street, there was construction. That's why there was the temporary, like, there was a wall that was barred you from looking at the construction site, whatever they were doing. So we were at the wall on one side of us and the temporary, I guess, like not gate, but something that comes up. Oh, actually, it wasn't solid. It was long pieces of wood or 2x4s, whatever. But it went over our heads. It was something we had to walk under and through. But yeah, when we turned around and went in that direction, and I realized, of course, way too late, whatever, that, and there was a person who was heading into it, the same opposite of us, walking towards us and we walking towards him, and we were mugged. So there you go. Even though we never saw a gun, you don't take chances. That's a bad example, because that was, while I didn't ignore it necessarily, I didn't go running, but I stayed with the group. I definitely wasn't about to leave on my own. My point is, my gut was right as far as it not being a safe situation. Okay, enough about guts. Jamie looks up when she says this and freaks. She flings herself on the ground, which she says likely saved her life. There's commotion and she's stepped on and it smells of ammonia and fish. Okay, that's gross. If you know what that's referring to, that's gross. It's not quite the evening meal they planned. It was, of course, a large black bear. Jamie, of course, was fighting it and hanging around its neck purposefully. He held on with one arm and stabbed with the other, and he was trying to pull the bear down. They topple. Jamie falls down, and he sees Claire and shouts, "Run!" Okay, that's the second time Diana has had someone mouth or say that word to Claire. And both times it's been where her life was at risk. This wasn't as freaky as when Galus did it, but it still gives me the shivers when anyone tells Claire to run. Claire refuses to run, are we surprised? And grabs a fish and hits the bear over the nose. It knocks her down and charges her, Jamie still hanging around its neck. Very surreal, this experience. Quote, leaving me lying bruised in the grass on my back, smelling strongly of bear piss and blinking up at the evening star, which was shining serenely overhead, unquote. I've never been attacked by a bear, thank God. Hope to never be. But I've had experiences where I've either been really sad or angry about something, usually not angry, some kind of suffering, whether you're sick or, I mean, attacked. I mean, I haven't been attacked, knock on wood, thank God. Or you're sad or something negative or not positive is going on, or you're in a state that is not ideal. And you're either lost in your emotion, lost in how you feel, lost in pain, whatever that is, like she is, like not having a great time at the moment. And she looks up and it's like, the world's going on without you, or while you're lying there bleeding to death. The star blinks back at you. You know what I mean? I could imagine that being completely surreal, looking up and it's like, oh, hey, Mr. Moon, I saw you. I see you. And Jamie and the bear are still fighting. She's yelling for Jamie, and he ends up slowly crawling into the clearing. He was covered in blood, but it wasn't his blood. So apparently she hit Jamie on the head with a fish. It wasn't the bear. Michael M. writes, if you've watched Jonah, a VeggieTales movie, you will catch my reference to Nineveh. At the conclusion of the bout, Jamie versus the black bear, Claire asks, is that your blood or the bear's? He answers, if it was mine, Sassenach, I'd be dead. No credit to you that I'm not, mind. He rolled painfully onto his side and slowly got to his hands and knees, groaning. What possessed you, woman, to hit me in the head with a fish whilst I was fighting for my life? Unquote. He's okay, just bruised and battered. The bear is dead, and she checks him. And then she checks the horses. Jamie, that is, not the bear. The bear had bobbed him good across the back. Quote, four long claw marks ran from shoulder blade to armpit. Unquote. He brushes it off. It's not as though my back was much to look at anyway, he says. That's true. So she says she'll tend to his wounds. And he says, dying in his sleep sounds even better now. In a call perhaps to the Eden that was the orchards at River Run, Diana writes, quote, small frogs sang all around me and the stiff leaves of cattails rustled softly in the evening breeze. It was very, very peaceful, unquote. It hits her that this could have been Jamie's time or hers. Anytime it can happen. She's collecting some herbs and leaves and then returns to the clearing. In a cool, calm voice, Jamie tells her to put his knife in his hand and get behind him. She sees three Indians across the fire, heavily armed. This must have been what provoked the bear. They were three, an older man and then two younger men. The older one had a gun, one of the younger ones a bow. Jamie puts his dirk on the ground, showing that he means no harm, and the Indians giggled. He speaks French to them. Nope. No English either. One of them mimicked the bear dying. They inquire about the bear, apparently. Jamie points to it. Jamie reassures her, Claire, that they're okay. The Indians are hunters. Quote, and a good thing too, because I think I'm maybe going to swoon. Unquote. Claire's like, you are not going to swoon. You are not going to vomit. You're going to stay here with me until these guys are gone. Claire forces his head between his legs. And she says, you will not faint and leave me here to deal with them alone. She goes, breathe. You can faint later.
Right? Keep it together.
You know that death you're talking about when you sleep? You can sleep when you're dead. That's what's going to happen. Jamie affirms that, yes, it had been him that had killed the bear. They made to give Jamie something. Quote, shoving me unceremoniously to one side, the younger man ripped open the throat of Jamie's shirt, pulled it off his shoulder, and squinted at the injury, unquote. And he put some paste on it. So they know a thing or two about some kind of healing. They knew that it was from the bear, and although it is pretty stanky, Jamie says. Jamie asks for the whiskey. One of the Indians made a grab, because Claire is going to get it, but she pushed him away. After Jamie had his fill, he offers it to the older man. They did a sort of ritual with the whiskey and the bear. Jamie is enthralled by the ritual taking place before him. The Indians included them both in the ritual with the smoking of the pipe. As Claire nearly chokes on it, the pipe, Jamie tells her, you didn't breathe it, Sassenach. Just let it rise up the back of your nose. Now you tell me, she says. The older man takes an interest in Claire. He reached out and squeezed her breast. He had wanted to assure himself that she was female. Yes, she was. And she was Jamie's. Michael M. writes, gender identification by groping. I promise to keep my hands to myself if I have the honor of meeting any of my Outlander Pod family face to face. Jamie beats them to the bear, insisting on doing the skinning. He does his own ritual. It was the Gralach prayer. It must be said for any animal slain that was larger than a hare, before the throat was cut or the belly skin split. Claire respects his surgical competence, as did the Indians. They're impressed with what he can do with a dirk and a bear. He offers the dirk to one of the younger Indians, and he tells Claire that the Indian had used whiskey for a charm, scattered holy water in the place of holy water to the four heirs of the earth, or the four directions, and to preserve themselves from evil. And of course, he means for the Indians, at least, it was from spirits. Jimmy basically pantomimes the attack, including Claire's role. They converse as well they might, and even get to exchanging names. The older one was Nacognoweto, whose name we might come across again, or maybe not. They were Tuscarora, and Jamie is already, of course, learning their language. Of course. Tired as anything and needing to retire, Claire makes sure that he'll be okay. She's like, "Will you be okay? I'm going to go." He's like, "Got it." She's like, "Good." And she curls up and goes to sleep. Lorraine B. writes, "In two of the three subjects they discuss, we are reminded how much Claire is very much her own woman and was able to rationally convince her doctor to let her birth naturally. Neither of them challenges or make fun of each other on their idea of how they want to die. They respect each other far too much. I love the humor in the midst of bear fighting when we find out that Claire has whacked Jamie across the face with a fish. It's a wonderful way to diffuse the seriousness of the situation." And Michael M. writes, "In any good story, there are turning points. Large ones that take the story in a new direction, and small ones where a character's perception is changed. In my opinion, this chapter is a turning point for Jamie. In the latter chapters of Voyager and the early chapters of this book, Jamie's perception of the Native Americans gives him great concern for his and Claire's safety and well-being. Here, he sees them for who they are." Quote, "And Jamie, horrified at the thought of savage Red Indians, had seen their rituals, so like his own, and known them at once for fellow hunters, civilized men. Even now, he was speaking to them quite naturally, explaining that with broad gestures how the bear had come upon us and how he killed it. They followed him with avid attention, exclaiming in appreciation in all the right places. When he picked up the remains of the mangled fish and demonstrated my role in the proceedings, they all looked at me and giggled hilariously." And then Michael strikes out hilariously and writes, "They all looked at me and giggled like ginger." Thanks a lot, Michael.
You're not a giggler.
Oh, Lord. Are you kidding me?
You don't giggle.
Can we get that on a shirt? A squealer?
I'm a squealer.
No.
Can we get that as a soundbite? Just so you can put it on repeat. I'm a squealer.
That was chapter 15.
As always, join us to continue the conversation in our Facebook community. Find us at outlanderpod.com/group.
If you want more information on how to join us, to join in on our read-along, you can go to www.outlanderpod.com/DOA.
If you love our show and are entertained by it, please consider visiting our Patreon page and consider supporting us. Every bit helps to cover our costs, be it hosting, recording equipment, etc. You can find our Patreon page at patreon.com/outlanderpod. There are also a number of free ways to help support our show. The most important way you can support us is to help spread the word. Tell your friends and family about the Outlander podcast. Thank you, as always, so much for listening. We look forward to our next episode. Thank you to our generous partner, Zencastr, who offers high-fidelity podcasting. Check out Zencastr and use coupon code OUTLANDER20, OUTLANDER20, for 20% off 3 months or 20% off for a year. Connect with us. Visit our website at outlanderpod.com. Find us on Facebook, facebook.com/outlanderpod. We'd love for you to join our Facebook community at outlanderpod.com/group. Follow us on Twitter and Instagram at @outlanderpod.